you can't help but not come to the logical conclusion that there is definitely some transmigration of life, life after life. If you actually take a scientific, logical approach, the average person will come to the conclusion that I'm open to the idea that there is something going on between lives. One of the biggest things I found that really convinced me was child prodigies.
Before we jump into this episode, I'd love to invite you to join this Candid Spiritual community to hear more conversations that will help you become happier, healthier, and more healed. All I want you to do is click on that subscribe button because I love your support. I love seeing all the comments pouring through, all the love pouring through, and we're just getting started. I can't wait to go on this journey with you, whether you're a spiritual seeker or you're just curious about the topic. And we really hope that our conversations will provide you food for thought and inspiration for your own spiritual journey. So join us for honest, candid discussions about spirituality for soul's sake.
For soul's sake, for soul's sake.
Hello, welcome to another episode of For Soul's Sake, a special in which I'm joined by two of my best friends, Kaylee Woods.
Hi.
And Nam on the other side.
Hello.
We are discussing all things spirituality in a candid way, in a fun way, and also in a way in which hopefully will help you to transform your life. So very much excited for this episode. We're talking, as always, from the Bhagavad Gita, the spiritual text which changed both of our, well, all of our lives. And today we've got an interesting topic, but before we get into that, what's been going on? Tell me, what's life been saying since we last recorded?
I went to Marrakesh.
Ooh.
That was really cool.
That's a very British thing. Ooh.
Yeah.
I saw those bit. They look cool.
It was exotic.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very Instagrammable place,
yeah.
I'd say. I went with my partner, Etty, and she had an interesting observation, which I didn't realise, because it's quite like rooftop life there.
Mm-hmm.
You can, you know, there's amazing buildings. And when you're on these rooftops, if you look over the skyline, so to say, the tallest buildings are the mosques.
Wow.
And I thought that was really interesting, an observation, how, you know, for a society in which divinity is important,
yeah,
it's even reflected in the architecture. No?
Yeah.
It's like, actually, no, even the highest thing that we can see in our surroundings is a place of worship.
Yeah. Yeah, I know that the founder of the Hare Krishna movement, he said something about New York in which the buildings are so tall and they represent the level of lust desire that the people in the country have,
yeah,
sex desire.
Yeah.
And so exactly what you said, like, what country nowadays idolizes spirituality or religion or divinity,
and
etc.
Even one step further.
Yeah, go on.
If you see the mosaic, the stucco architecture, everything there, even the designs inside the riads and the mosques, at first you see them and you're like, oh, they're just like leaves or nature or shapes or birds. But every design has a name of God written into it. So
in Arabic.
Yeah.
Mm.
So if you don't have the vision, you just see a leaf or a vine, but actually it says Allah.
Oh,
just in a
wow,
kind of... it's creative way.
Funny, because I was actually in New York. Funny you mentioned New York, like 2 weeks ago. And everyone loves like the cityscape of New York, the landscape. Oh, it's beautiful, tall buildings. And like, you're totally right. Like the churches and the place for worship are the shortest.
Mm.
And it's the places to make money, the banks, which are the biggest skyscrapers. But everyone loves like the New York landscapes that are really beautiful. And yeah, at night it looks really cool. But when you actually look at the buildings, they're really nothing special.
They're
it's like
square
the worst
boxes.
The worst, like, shade of beige,
mm,
and just, like, small squared windows all over the place. And, like, comparing to, like, what you saw in Marrakesh, like, the divinity is in all the detail, right? Divinity is in the detail of the architecture, and you really see that.
Yeah.
It's quite interesting.
How about you? What have you been up to?
Went to my first NBA game, which was, like, nothing I've experienced before. It wasn't a game. It was a whole Broadway performance.
Well, like intermissions and people dancing.
Yeah,
and
like
stuff.
The guy next to me in New York, and he was telling me, like, I was saying to him, wow, this, like, it's only a, you know, there's only four quarters to a basketball game, so it should only take 60 minutes with some breaks. But he goes, no, we let it go on for 2 hours. This is like a thing. And the interesting thing about New York, and I think this is different from London, is I always find it fascinating how certain people own their city and their place of
You mean owned by, like, they're really proud of it?
They're proud of it.
Yeah.
And some places, they just abuse their cities. So in New York, everyone's a big family. It's like, yeah, this is New York. This is our place. We're all here together. We're a family. We're here to contribute, you know, no matter where you are from. But living in London, I don't think I've ever felt like that. I don't think I've ever felt like this is my city and feeling at one with the people of that place.
We're not very patriotic in the UK, are we?
Not really.
No. It's probably a lot of conflict.
There's not much to be proud of. The underwhelming weather and scones.
Our cameraman's gone.
Scones are pretty good.
Do you know what I mean, though?
Yeah, yeah.
We had some kirtan musicians from New York come and stay in London, and they said, everything's grey here.
Yeah.
The sky is grey. The food tastes grey.
Yeah.
But I feel... And maybe this is a relevant spiritual point as well.
There we go.
If you can be happy in London, you can be happy anywhere.
Yeah,
I really feel like that.
Totally.
You got the passion. The weather's not that great. It's like a bit stressful. But if you can find your nook, if you can find your community, your service, your peace of mind, it just makes everything else seem a little easier.
Yeah, I know, totally. Totally. It was funny, actually, in New York, because it's a very intense place. Like, I've become very conscious of energies of the environment that I stay in. And New York's great and it's exciting, but a couple of days there and you're wiped.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, your consciousness is taken over and you're feeling exhausted.
That's true.
Then I spent half an hour on that weekend just to visit a friend at the Buckley Center in New York. And just in that one conversation, which was just an hour over dinner, I just felt at peace. You just feel at home. You just feel like this conversation is worth having. It's fulfilling. And all the tribulations of the city kind of sort of start to shift and end up in a little bubble. And I thought that was quite a nice haven, actually, from the busyness of New York City.
Yeah, find good association.
You probably see that all the time when you go to New York.
Yeah, I mean, traveling now, it's weird. Like, now that I'm traveling a lot more than I ever dreamed I thought I would, it's weird. You almost feel like the whole world feels the same.
Yeah.
Like,
it's like variations on a theme.
Variations on the same thing. It's like there's nothing distinctly different for me because I've been to Marrakesh, I've been to New York. And for me, okay, like, yes, there's some cultural differences, but I just don't see them anymore.
Mm.
I feel like almost like I'm in the same country and I'm just traveling from, like...
It's all kind of merged.
It's all merging, yeah. It's strange.
Humans are humans, right?
Yeah. But it doesn't shock me anymore when someone speaks another language, is what I mean. Like, or it doesn't shock me when I see... I'm not, like, struck by anything anymore, which is weird. Maybe I need to spend time in a completely different atmosphere, like, not in a city, but in nature, and maybe that will, again, spark my interest for...
There is this idea, though, of samadarshana, right? Of this, like, equal vision. And I think anyone that's attempting some form of spiritual life is trying to... see that, like, unity in the diversity, if that makes sense.
Yeah. The pain experienced by everyone is the same, what country you come from. Like, everyone's experiencing anxiety, depression, or loneliness, whether you're from Marrakesh, New York, London, Australia. Like, it really doesn't matter, I think.
Yeah. It's hard for us to also, like, when we see war-torn countries, for example, for us to feel the pain of the people... It's hard because we can only feel the pain up until the extremity of what we've experienced pain to be.
Yeah.
Totally. Like, you can't fully experience. And so that's why it almost equals out. Like, you, I don't know if this makes any sense at all, but there you go.
Yeah. I mean, pain is a very interesting topic because it looks different for different people, but it could be just as intense. Like, I don't know, you could take, like, a multimillionaire who might actually feel the pain of loneliness and isolation.
This is what I mean. Yeah.
And then, yeah, perhaps the pain of a poor person looks very different, but it might be just as intense, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
That's exactly what I was trying to get across. Thank you.
That's such a good point. Let's open that up a little bit because this is often one of the biggest misconceptions in, like, spirituality, that the pain of someone in a lesser fortunate position is greater than the pain of someone in a externally more fortunate position. So the loneliness felt at for a rich person and a poor person, it doesn't mean the rich person is necessarily better off.
Yeah.
Actually, they perhaps come to the conclusion that all of the stuff I've gained, all the effort that I put in to make my millions, has really just been completely
It's almost more
useless.
Painful, isn't it?
More painful,
because,
yeah.
Because like at least someone who doesn't have that luxury can say, but I can do something about it one day. You know, I'll buy all the friends in the world.
You can still have hope.
Yeah, right.
Do you know what? There's a story. Maybe this leads us on to our verse.
Woofed.
There's a story, this article I read about 5 years ago of this multi-millionaire who had yachts in Saint-Tropez and used to travel the world and everything. And he was like, okay, I've got all this money. I'm going to live my life. I'm going to live it up. I'm going to, you know, live that luxury life. And it was front page of the newspaper that he'd committed suicide on his yacht. He was found and he'd shot himself on the yacht. And all he'd left was a note. And the note said, I've seen it all. I've done it all. And I'm still not happy.
Damn.
I've seen it all, I've done it all, and I'm still not happy.
Yeah. And so can you imagine he had all of the resource, all of the facility that you could ever have, and he was like, no, I'm not happy.
And yet still, we feel that our chase is different.
Right.
Yeah.
We've convinced ourselves that, no, I'm not doing what that yacht guy did.
Yeah.
My chase is different, and therefore I'm going to get a different result.
Yeah.
But actually, in the macro sense, the chase is exactly the same.
And it's not the goal that's intoxicating, it's the chase.
Yeah.
And so you chase and you chase and you chase, and you realize, I'm just going round in circles.
I can't imagine spending, 40, 50 years of your life sacrificing time, relationships, family, your own health, only to find out it was all useless.
Yeah.
All futile.
And that's why we've got to peel away the layers, who am I when everything that is not me, everything that I'm chasing is not true? Who is that I beyond all of that? When I peel away all the layers of, all the different dynamics of my life, what's left in the center? And I guess here comes the verse then. We're talking from chapter 2, text number 13, the translation. As the embodied soul continuously passes in this body from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at death. A sober person is not bewildered by such a change.
That's a far out verse.
Mm. It's a famous verse.
Sober doesn't mean like
not drunk.
Yeah. I've chosen not to have a bevy before I die. That's not what we're talking about, right? How are we defining sober? What's a sober person?
Steady minded. Someone that is, in one sense, not clouded by illusion.
Mm.
They're not affected by the volatility of the ups and downs of the world.
Right.
A sober person is able to be steady, despite the inevitable ups and downs of the world and pulls and pushes of it. I think this is the biggest pull and push, right? That verse is talking about is the fact that life is temporary, and even though I don't like it, I'm never comfortable with it.
Mm.
I think that's always a very interesting thing. It's the most guaranteed thing in life, but we're never comfortable when it happens. It always seems to strike a chord with anyone, even if you don't know the person.
There's that famous one, right, by Yudhishthir Maharaj, who says that the most amazing thing in the world is that we see death all around us, but we never think it's going to happen to us.
It's never
going to happen. I remember as a child having nightmares of death. I don't know is that a weird thing?
No,
but
normal.
I remember just having nightmares and thinking, oh my god, this life is temporary. And we almost cloud it over with responsibilities, with roles, with relationships, with things. And then you end up going, I'll live forever. And then even, people who are old, they're always thinking about, how am I going to live forever through legacy? What legacy am I leaving that I'm going to... But the truth is, even though we love Michael Jackson and people are probably still listening to him, but then let's rewind a few years before and let's go Elvis Presley. Again, fewer people listen to... Let's go to the Beatles. Fewer people listen to... And then you go even further back, Mozart. Maybe there's one or two people listen. It's like your legacy becomes less and less important as time goes on. And then you figure out, it's okay to die. And all the things that are associated with me, it's okay for me to let them go.
You just become a memory.
Yeah.
And when enough time passes, people even question whether you existed. right?
Yeah.
When you think about like Jesus, people even question like, what is the validity of the claims we make?
What's the proof
Jesus?
That Jesus existed?
Yeah.
Damn, man.
It just shows like, actually.
I used to listen to this band called MGMT.
Uh-huh.
And there was a...
I'm trying to work out what that stands for.
I don't actually know.
Oh, okay.
Maybe you can leave in the comment sections if you know.
Yes, please.
But there's a line, you might have to help me if you know this line. One of their lyrics is, this is our decision to live fast and die young. Now let's have some fun, right? And it was like, I remember we were all singing that at the time, like, live fast and die young. That was kind of the motto, right? Mm. But the Bhagavad Gita actually kind of gives a different perspective because it says the soul is eternal. So better to spend this very short life preparing for eternity rather than just, you know, like squandering it. And that's why we have these four things, right? Janma, Mrityu, Jara, Vyadhi. We have birth, death, old age and disease. And actually, it's not just death we have to come to terms with. It's the other three as well. There's we can't escape it.
Kaylee, what's actually the lyrics to that song? Because I think I remember hearing them and they're quite deep as well.
I got them here. So it says, the song's called Time to Pretend, and I think it's about pretending that you're not eternal, basically. Just pretending that you're in this fleeting material body.
Are they like a spiritual band?
They were kind of like psychedelic, I guess.
All right, yeah.
But they say, this is our decision to live fast and die young. We've got the vision, now let's have some fun. And the verse says, yeah, it's overwhelming, but what else can we do? Get jobs in offices and wake up for the morning commute. And it's like, I think they're just saying, actually, if you don't have knowledge of the eternal, then, yeah, you just have to play your part. It's like it's like life becomes a pantomime or something. And
if you don't want to know, then you just might as well just like be ignorant and live ignorantly.
And also, some people, they do know, they find out and they're like, that's a bit overwhelming.
Yeah.
That's a bit too much. I don't want to come to terms with the fact that I'm eternal. I'm just going to like get on with my job and live fast and die young.
I find that's harder.
Yeah.
Because once you know and you know too much, it's very difficult to just pretend and live a very materialistic life as you initially were
doing. You're in a spiritual mafia now.
What do you do, though? What do you do about that?
Like, ask yourself the question, right? Like,
you've got to be brave. Like, there has to be a bit of courage about acknowledging... There's an analogy that came to... Well, not even an analogy, it's a story. Prabhupada is with his disciple, Vishnujan.
Mm-hmm.
And Vishnujan is asking Prabhupada, like, what shall I do in my next steps in my spiritual life? Like, how do I improve my spiritual practice? And Prabhupada says, look into that corner. What do you see? In the corner of the room, what do you see? And Vishnujan says, I see nothing. And Prabhupada says, I see the dust on the floor. That means that Krishna has allowed me to see the dust, and therefore, because he's allowed me to see the dust, I should clean it up.
I have some service now.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, in respect of what we're talking about, like doing something about the fact that we are eternal beings in these material bodies, once you know that, once you've acknowledged it, you've got to be brave enough to do something. Otherwise, we have to ask ourselves the question, what am I pretending not to see? What am I pretending to avoid? What am I pretending to even not acknowledge?
You know, I think that brings us back to that word sober. Because as someone that used to be intoxicated a lot, in my experience, we intoxicate to numb ourselves from the reality, which can be overwhelming. So actually, like you said, it takes bravery to be sober. It takes bravery to actually accept the conditions of life, birth, death, old age, disease. I'm going to be brave. What do I do about this situation?
You almost have to sit in solitude, because the fact is that all of those things, I mean, apart from birth, I guess, because we don't have much control over birth, all the other things, you only can heal through them in solitude. No one can, when you've got illness, no one's like, oh, like, I'm going to cure it for you. They can help you, But ultimately, your body has to do the healing.
We have to deal with it.
And the same thing with old age. Like, someone can help you through old age, but ultimately, you have to deal with the fact that you're getting old. And same with death. There might be 100 people around you when you're dying, but the fact is, you're going to have to take that journey.
You have to accept the fact that disease will never leave you. Yeah. You might get cured of a particular disease, but the fact is, it's always coming back, right?
Yeah, it's always between, as Mother Teresa says, it's between you and God anyway.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, it was always between you and God anyway.
I wanted to open up the conversation into, like, reincarnation.
Ooh.
And see, because that's kind of controversial for some people.
It's actually controversial. But it's also a little bit like, I don't know, woo-woo.
Right. However,
come on then.
It can be woo-woo, but something I find is, so I'm an engineer by background, so I like to think about things logically, analytically, in processes, right? When I first, like, was thinking about reincarnation, if you actually understand the science and logic of the soul, and you read things like the Bhagavad Gita to really understand what is the dynamics of the soul, how does it work, what's its nature, is it temporary, is it eternal, etc., then you look at certain phenomena that we continually see in the world that's been done through loads of research on past life regressions, you can't help but not come to the logical conclusion that there is definitely some transmigration of life, life after life. If you actually take a scientific, logical approach, the average person will come to the conclusion that I'm open to the idea that there is something going on between lives.
Yeah.
Things like, one of the biggest things I found that really convinced me was child prodigies. Like, when you see a lot of these child prodigies, like 5 years old, can play Mozart like no one who's been practicing for 30 years can speak languages that aren't even spoken on planet Earth anymore. That was another one. There's an actual word for it. I can't remember the word, but there was one girl, and she could speak ancient Chinese languages, oriental languages, which just haven't been spoken for hundreds of years.
From birth?
Yeah, like from as soon as she could start speaking, wow. Basically. Where does that come from? How do you scientifically understand that?
You know, that's such a good point.
There's not been enough like media projected research. Yeah. Like, there's research out there, but it's all kind of categorized as no, it's what's it called? It's a conspiracy.
Yeah.
You know, there's no such thing. For me, I could only accept reincarnation when I came faced with a question: why do bad things happen to good people? It was the only way I could accept that there was a possibility that I've had a life before this, because it doesn't make any sense otherwise. Like, you know, you have a belief in a divine structure, like, okay, whether it be the G word or the absolute, the universe, you have an understanding of something greater than what's on this planet, and then you strip back and you go, okay, so I've got some sort of faith in that, but then how does it make sense about this journey and all the things I'm experiencing? Like, why is God doing this to me? Like, it doesn't make any sense.
Just one scene of a big movie that you haven't seen yet.
Yeah.
I always give the example, like, when we talk about why bad things happen to good people, if you go midway into a cinema, into a movie, right, and someone's getting stabbed and beaten up, you're like, oh my God, why are you doing that to that person? Well, that's really
Can
bad.
Can you just do,
like,
the oh my God again?
Oh my God. I don't know what that is. I don't know what accent that one is, but hey ho.
And then, I don't think we should describe any nationality to that. That's a bit risky.
Yeah, that's very offensive.
We won't be PC then.
No,
offensive.
That could be one of many things.
It's just a nom.
Yeah, it's just a nom. Let's call it a nom.
It's just nom, yeah. And so, anyway, you walk into the movie and someone's getting beaten up, stabbed, killed, etc.
Oh my
and then
God.
You're like, oh my God, that's a really bad person, right? You come to that conclusion, that's a really bad person.
Yeah.
You haven't seen the first half of the movie.
Yeah.
You don't know what went on in those beginning scenes to make that conclusion, right? And if you did, perhaps you'd shift your mind.
Unless it was Tom Cruise, then you're like, Tom Cruise isn't going to play a bad guy.
No.
Yeah, he never plays a bad guy.
Yeah.
But also, why do good things happen to bad people?
Yeah. Right?
It's the same. It's the same exact thing. Same question.
Yeah. Explain Stalin to me.
Yeah.
Explain Hitler. Kim Jong-un. Explain it.
But I guess This then begs another. Yeah. Go for it.
Yeah, no, I'm saying not to say that I'm saying that those people are bad people. Put out there.
But what is people. Good things? Right?
What is the definition thing? Of a good thing? What's the definition
what
of a bad
thing? What is actually thing? Good things? Are we talking? And I think when we mainly ask that question, we mean from a materialistic resource perspective. Mm. I've been given money, opportunity, power, those kind of things, right? Which are greatly looked after. But
is that necessarily a good thing?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, does power mean that you've received something good? Does money mean you've received something good? Depends what you do with it, right? Was it the knife in the hand of a surgeon and the knife in the hand of the thief?
Mm.
Or murderer, whatever.
The thing is, there has to be some standard for good and bad, and that standard has to be absolute.
Mm.
It cannot be relative, because if good is a relative concept, then, you know, anyone can decide what's good and bad, right? So intrinsically, we all know hurting someone else is bad, right? But if there's no absolute standard to hold that claim up to, it's a free-for-all. Yeah. So where do we get that absolute standard? I would argue that comes from religious texts or spiritual wisdom, right?
I mean, even if you go through the origin of law, it does have its basis in religion.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the time, in most countries, it is based on the religious standard of the country, whether it's Islamic law, whether it's... Okay, fine, in the UK, they still call it... They say it's secular. We have a secular legal system. But when you look at some of the laws, it is based on some of the church texts.
Hugely.
So,
I wanted to mention this guy, Ian Stevenson. Have you heard of him?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Famous guy in the world of reincarnation. Because if you've never heard of him, it means you don't know about reincarnation.
Yeah, he was interesting. He was a full-on atheistic scientist, right? Everything he believed had to be empirical. So he set out to disprove reincarnation. And after amassing over 1,000 case studies, personal studies of people's, you know, claims and different scientific experiments, he became so convinced that he almost became a religious preacher for reincarnation. And he would travel and do seminars.
Good old Ian.
And it's so interesting, isn't it? Did you hear any of the case studies, any of the stories?
I remember something briefly, like a girl born in a different part of the world.
Yeah.
Then wanted to travel back to India. She had pinpointed the exact village, the exact place where she had been a child. She went into the room where she used to sleep and said, that's where I used to sleep. And all the villagers had attested to it. If you just check it out on Google, Ian Stevenson case studies, you'll find hundreds.
There was a similar one about this little boy, and I think they lived somewhere in the US.
But the fighter pilot one?
No. Oh, this is a different one. That's a good story you should tell, but... There's one in the US, and he used to always draw this building where he says, it's my home, this is my home, this is my house, I own this house. And mother's like, what? You're like a five-year-old boy. Anyway, he seems to be really obsessive about it. They somehow track this place down. They go all the way to this place somewhere in Europe. They open the door. An old man opens the door, and the little boy's there. The little boy looks at the old man and says, my son.
What? Far out.
That's my son. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Some of the stories are just like, you know, this is facts. Like Ian Stevenson's work is facts. I can't sit there. This goes back to the thing we talked about earlier.
Mm.
Shall we pretend I'm not seeing this? Mm. Shall we pretend I'm not hearing this fact?
Right.
Someone's done genuine research. The facts are there. Hey, look. I cannot deny. If I'm a genuine truth seeker, I cannot deny the presentings that have been found there, right?
Yeah. I also find it really strange that any human being can live their whole life without even challenging their belief structure.
Yeah.
I find that really strange. Just because I've had, up until the age of 33 I am now, I've had a lot of like experiences that have challenged my beliefs, and that's molded my, well, what I think.
Schmolded.
Schmolded. it's molded my... My current belief structure. But anyone that's like not even experienced or even explored it, it's like, just at least just check it out, you know? Like, you want to encourage people to check it out. But I guess, look, those of you that are watching this podcast, you probably already believe what we're saying. You're just like, you're looking for ammo to give to your family or something. So if you're looking for ammo, Ian Stevenson.
There are these two images, though, that come to mind. One of them is this experiment. I would say don't try it, but you probably will.
Mm-hmm.
You get a blank piece of paper and you put an ant on the piece of paper, and all you do simply with a Sharpie marker is draw a circle, a closed circle around the ant, and you see that they think that they're stuck, they're encased, when it's just pen on paper, right? And there's another example of, you see this guy herding sheep, a huge...
shepherd.
Yeah, a huge... what's the name for lots of sheep? It's not a flock, is it?
A herd of sheep.
A herd. Yeah. Is it a herd of sheep?
I think so.
Oh, we're going to go down a rabbit hole here.
Flock of sheep.
Sheeps.
You can't say sheep. No, you're not allowed. Grammatically incorrect. Anyway, sheeps. There were lots of sheep.
Herd of sheep. Flock of sheep. Flock of sheep. Flock of sheep sounds right.
Yeah? Flock of sheep. Okay, great. So you see that there's an open field and there's one gate, but there's no like... there's no fence either side of the gate, but still the sheep are trained to go through the gate. There's nothing stopping them from just walking around it, but they're so trained. So it's, I just give these two examples to show how powerful the mind can be in accepting a certain paradigm. And if we're conditioned into a certain paradigm that's also convenient for us and supports our current standard of life and comfort, we're not going to be as inclined to challenge those beliefs, you know. It might be convenient to say, no, actually there's nothing after this life, because when you, if you have to come to terms with that fact that maybe there is, that means I have to watch less Netflix, I have to take up a spiritual practice, I have to prepare myself in some way or another. It's not so convenient, you know,
the burden of the fact that I didn't figure it all out,
right?
There was something I didn't really look at,
right?
It comes to play, right?
Yeah.
I'm trying to find this quote that you just reminded me of. Keep talking, I'll find it. Oh, here we go. No, it's not that one. Keep going. I'll find it.
Now, there was, just on this topic, actually, there's a really interesting story that I once read, and it's quite a famous story in the history of science. This lady, she had a brain aneurysm.
Right.
So basically, there's a, you know, an artery in her brain, a vein, which has had an aneurysm, and they needed to perform a surgery on it. But in order to perform surgery on her brain aneurysm, it's a very risky surgery. They have to stop the blood flow in order to effectively do the surgery on her brain.
Right.
Right. So what that meant was they had to artificially, clinically kill her.
Right.
They had to clinically make her body dead. So they sucked out all the fluids in her brain so they could, you know, do surgery without it causing too much of a risk, and they had to artificially pump her lungs with some sort of fluid or something. But she was basically dead. No oxygen, no blood to the brain, right? And they said during that 15-minute or 45-minute window, they would perform the operation, then they would try and restore the body. So she had been searching for doctors to do this for a long time. Everyone was rejecting it. Then she found a set of doctors in the US who said, okay, we'll do this for you. They did it. And after the experience, the surgery was a success, she goes, you won't imagine what I just experienced. She goes, during that 45-minute window, I was above my body, I was looking down, I could hear everything you were saying, I could see everything you were doing, I could see all the jokes that you were making, the doctors and nurses were making together. I could hear you pronounce certain instruments, which I don't know the name of because I'm obviously not a medical practitioner, but I was observing you do this on my brain whilst my body was clinically dead.
Wow.
Can you imagine that?
There's a similar story that my spiritual teacher experienced while he was on the surgery table. And while he was obviously unconscious, he had an out-of-body experience similar to that. Exactly that, in fact. He was in the room, they were performing the surgery, and the surgeon was talking to his colleagues about golf. And he said, yeah, I hit a perfect shot. And he said he indicated it by taking the scalpel and going like this. And as he went like that, he cut one of the arteries. And then they all panicked. And they started, like, you know, obviously they fixed it and everything is all fine. And then he came out of the surgery and obviously, Maharaj, he came back to consciousness. And then the doctor came in the room and said, yeah, so everything went well. There was a little hiccup there. And then Maharaj said, yeah, why are we talking about golf? And the surgeon just went, like, what the hell? Like, how did you know that we were talking? So, the subtle thing is, it's a real thing. I mean, I have faith in it.
Yeah. I love this kind of stuff. Like, I find it so fascinating.
Next, we're going to talk about the moon.
The moon?
landing on the moon. Yeah, conspiracy theories. We should just call this, like, I don't know, conspiracies. Anyway, the quote that I found, you know, based on what we're talking about, like lies and all that. Here's the thing, you want to hear it. If someone tells a lie loud enough and long enough, others begin to accept it as truth. When enough people are convinced by that truth, it becomes a culture. If that culture is somehow transmitted to the next generation, it becomes a tradition. Such traditions and the worldviews and behaviors they espouse become etched into society, followed by millions, usually without question.
Mm.
You know, it's interesting. It even goes on to say, our weapons of mass instruction, instruction, educational systems, media powerhouses, and community structures reinforce these traditions, causing untruth to perpetuate over decades and centuries.
Mm.
Blind leading the blind, all completely oblivious to the illusion.
It's a powerful thing.
Makes me think, I was with a friend last night who, she runs a pottery studio, and she used to work as a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And she was saying, the day I quit, I sat down at my desk and there was a bag of lollipops in front of me. And so she had one lollipop and she was like, you know what? I could just eat all of these lollipops right now. There's nothing stopping me. And so she did. She just had all of the lollipops. I think she felt a little sick afterwards, but she was like, it was so liberating.
Yeah.
And it gave her this realization, like, I have free will.
Mm,
yeah.
And she went into her garden and she kicked off her lawyer heels and walked on the grass, and she was like, for this whole time I've been wearing this mask and keeping up this appearance of trying to be someone or something.
Yeah.
And I thought that was quite an interesting way to see life, and almost I would encourage everyone listening to think, how can we challenge our beliefs a little bit every day? What can we do to really just think, is this true for me? Is this right? Is this good? Is this...
Yeah.
You know,
we don't have to necessarily slip into anarchy. We don't have to be like anti-establishment and kick the doors down and everything. I appreciate there's time and place for that also, but there's just space for internal revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
internal kicking the doors down.
Mm.
Let's start there. I think that makes more sense.
Start with ourselves, right?
Start with ourselves. Yeah. Start with ourselves. Don't need to change the world.
Mm.
There's also like this interesting point about people are sometimes can be very attached to their own belief system.
Yeah.
And because they're very attached to their own belief system, we don't want to challenge our own belief system hard enough. And I think that's the difference between, could you say, someone who's very religious relative to someone who's actually very spiritual.
Yeah.
Because the spiritual seeker is always seeking truth and therefore willing to challenge their own belief structure and system, whereas a religious person in its, you know, in the connotation it's used today...
Yeah.
Is very attached to a particular set of beliefs and that and nothing but that. So I totally resonate. Like, there's so much room to
challenge. This is a fun topic. We could go all day, but I reckon we should close off here. And what are your thoughts? How did you feel about what we're sharing here? Is it ruffling the feathers? And if it is, we're kind of happy about that. I don't know about you guys.
I'm
happy it's ruffling some feathers. I hope it's making you think about who you are, the process of dying and getting old, what's beyond. Do some research, find out. Maybe this Ian Stevenson is going to pique your interest, or maybe, you know, something else that was in part of this conversation. And yeah, we really hope that it's helpful for you, and really hope that it's going to bring you to the next stage or the next step of your spiritual journey. Having said this much, we look forward to seeing you on the next episode of For Soul's Sake. Thank you so much for joining us. From Kaylee, from Naam and myself, see you soon.
See ya.
If you love this podcast, you'll love my interview with Ambika Devi on how art and spirituality can be used to make a difference in this world.
The only way you can really be happy is when you serve others and when you have a purpose to connect with God. That's the only way you will be happy. Otherwise, no money, no fame, no beauty, nothing can really fulfill you, you know? And then we are living beings that the only thing that can fulfill us is love and service.